Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 127games.com.
Hello, and welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network to discuss historical and New England gaming. This is episode 105, Wargames Holiday Center. So every episode, I say, is a special episode, and that's true, but today's episode is extra special for a few reasons. First of all, this is the last episode we're recording for the 2013 calendar year. I know you're sad, but don't worry, we'll be back better than ever after the break. But the second reason why this is exceptional is there's not one, but two incredible guests joining us today. I am delighted and deeply honored to have John and his wife Diane Sutherland joining us to talk about all of the wonderful things that they do in the world of wargaming. John, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you, Jonathan.
I've been looking forward to us chatting for an incredibly long time.
Yeah, me too, and it's really crept up on me.
Well, you know how it's kind of become popular for people to have their bucket lists of things that they want to do before they kick the bucket? For me, one of the things that I've wanted to do for a while for the show is to have the two of you on. I've followed you guys for what feels like a long time, and it may only have been a few years, but admire all of the stuff that you do. So I'm like a kid in a candy store with you being on the line right now.
Thank you very much. I'm blushing, and it's probably not been a matter of years. It's actually felt like a matter of decades that we've been involved in wargaming.
Well, you go way back, and this is something that's really interesting to me because for me it's kind of a hidden tidbit of information, and I'm sure others who are more knowledgeable about wargaming already knew this. But when I got my start in wargaming, it was through the whole Games Workshop kind of stuff, playing Warhammer 40K, Warhammer Fantasy. And one of the things that I always looked forward to was reading the new issue of White Dwarf magazine. And you were an editor, albeit before I started playing, but you were an editor back in the 1980s, was it?
Yeah, it was. It was around 82, 83, and I suppose I was the last, if I can say it, the last independent editor of White Dwarf. It was before it went corporate. So I handled the last few issues before it went up to Nottingham and became basically Games Workshop's in-house magazine. I mean, it was always Games Workshop's in-house magazine because we pushed products and role-playing ranges which either Games Workshop printed or distributed in the UK. But after that point, when it moved up to Nottingham, it became solely Warhammer and then subsequently 40K and that kind of thing, you know, just purely their product.
Well, in their earliest days, I know they were one of the primary retailers of Dungeons & Dragons product. I had read this book called Of Dice and Men, and I was surprised to see Games Workshop and some of the wargaming greats mentioned in it, because I'm thinking, this is a book about role-playing games. How are they going to talk about wargaming? But they had sections on it, and they talked a fair bit about the early days of Games Workshop, like you said, before
the transition. Workshop actually kicked off in the 70s, I think, and they mainly did classic games, the Go and chess and all of those kind of all those sort of Japanese games, which were pretty hard to find in Europe. And then they sort of moved into, I think they were into Dungeons & Dragons or got into Dungeons & Dragons. And by the late 70s and early 80s, they were selling more Dungeons & Dragons, and they were actually printing softback players' handbooks and Dungeon Master's guides than TSR were actually selling. So it was kind of weird because TSR were bringing the stuff over from the States, sticking it in the warehouse for 5 minutes, and then it was going out on a truck to Games Workshop to be sold. So it was a period that beginning of the 1980s was a period where Dungeons and Dragons was massive and growing at such a rate, and workshops kind of rode on that big carpet, you know, the big magic carpet, and it was exciting, and that's really where my background with wargaming. I used to play Ancients and Renaissance wargaming, historical wargaming in the 70s. But by the early 1980s, I was into fantasy and science fiction to an extent. And I met, and it's sort of quite fortuitous because it kind of dovetails the two things that we're going to talk about a bit today. Both the Mega Wargames book and Wargame Holidays is, in 1981, having left university with a politics degree and with no clue as to what it is I wanted to do, I ended up working in a shop. But it wasn't an ordinary shop. It was the wargame shop in the UK, probably in the world at that time, and that was on Oxford Street. And there I met a guy called Joe Deaver, who probably a lot of your listeners would now know better as being the guy who devised Lone Wolf. It's globally massive. He's sold 10, 12 million copies of his books and everything. But back then, we were both shop assistants. And we were both really into wargaming. And we've remained friends for, well, gosh, it's 35 years. And funnily enough, one of the latest things that I've just done is the Mega Wargame book with Joe taking all the photographs. And the Wargame Holidays comes out of an event that he and I went to in, I think it was 82. We went to a Wargame Holiday Centre in Scarborough, and I'm not, I guess probably a lot of your listeners wouldn't have heard of Scarborough, but it's a bleak, windswept, northeastern seaside town in England, which has got very little to commend it, but it did have Peter Gilder, who is one of the godfathers of wargaming, designed thousands of figures, fantastic painter, wonderful terrain. Some of his techniques are still being used today. Well, a lot of his techniques are still being used today. Horsehair to make trees and all of those kind of things. And we were just blown away by seeing so many soldiers in one place at the same time, and we just could not fathom how it could be done, how many soldiers he had and how many periods he could offer and that kind of thing. And that stuck in my head for 30 odd years, that one day I'll do that. So I've got a lot to thank Workshop for, because I met a lot of my mates who remain friends, Jervis Johnson, Rick Priestley, people like that, John Stallard, who runs Warlord Games, people like that. They're all contemporaries, you know, and we've all been involved in wargaming in one way, shape, or form ever since. We haven't been able to shake it out of our systems.
It's been really surreal for me because of befriending people like you and Henry Hyde and a few others on through the internet that I've made the very fringe kind of connections with some of the people that you've mentioned, people whose games I played, because like I said, I got my start playing games with Games Workshop and playing Warhammer 40K, Warhammer Fantasy, Battlefleet Gothic, and a lot of those, and seeing certain names show up at the masthead every time. Oh, designed by so-and-so, designed by so-and-so, or they've written books and articles, and then being able to have, like, it really is an extremely fringe kind of link, but a link to some of these people online. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I got a link to, I think it may have been Gav Thorpe, and I was like, whoa, I got this link, and how did this happen? It felt really weird to me, and then when I was able to see, oh, well, they have this person in common and this person in common, and that your name kept popping up over and over with a bunch of these individuals as being a shared connection, I felt very, like, it was an out-of-body experience for me. exciting at the same time. People like you, who I have only ever really read about or experienced from an extreme distance, and being able to peer behind the curtain, so to speak, to get these glimpses at things. It's wonderful.
It's strange because I don't know, particularly with the historical wargaming, everything seems to gravitate around, probably a lot of your listeners will know this, around a city called Nottingham, which is around about 3 hours, 3.5 hours drive north of London, and it's the epicenter of probably of global wargaming, because all of the big manufacturers are in and around there. The magazines are all printed around there, and there's lots of casters, lots of the retail stores and manufacturers and designers. The Perrys are there. Warlord Games are there. War Games Illustrated is there. So it's become, and of course Games Workshop is in Nottingham as well, which goes without saying. But it's an interesting place because it's very strange how Nottingham has become so important to wargaming, and really it's born out of the fact that bunch of people who were contemporaries with one another in the 80s have all moved on, stayed in the wargaming market, but have built their own businesses subsequent to that. So, and they've all obviously got their ties and their roots in the Nottingham area. And, you know, it's a bit of a mafia. it's about knowing the right people and all that kind of thing. But it's fascinating that there's one industrial park in Nottingham, which has probably got 12 or so wargame companies on the one industrial park. And of course, they're in and out of one another's units all day. You know,
it sounds like a place I need to go visit.
Yeah, I think you do. And War Games Illustrated is slap bang right in the middle of it all. You know, so they've got the first kind of call on anything that's coming up and everything, and access to new stuff as it arrives and all of that. But it's amazing because it's. I was in the States about a year ago, and pleased to see that there are some war game stores, not many, but there are some, and you certainly got better hobby stores than we've got, you know, general hobby stores. But over here, for a long time, because of Workshop's dominance of the market, there's been very few independent stores, but now that's kind of turning around. Primarily because there's a lot more product. There's a lot more non-Games Workshop, professionally produced product in blister packs and nicely produced rule booklets and that kind of thing. So there's stuff for them to sell that's non-Workshop. And it's actually quite nice to see, because I really miss the days that I used to spend. We used to, every month or 6 weeks, we used to save our money up and go round, do a pilgrimage round the war game shops in London. And, you know, there was four or five to go to, you know, and you'd have your shopping list and each of them would be stocking different manufacturers. And you go around, but they're all gone. All of them are gone. You won't find more than probably two very, very general hobby stores in London now, which is a shame.
Up here in New England, I feel that we're very lucky because there are so many incredible local game stores that are just outstanding. They're out of this world. A lot of them are at the most basic stores that really rely heavily on the Magic the Gathering card game. Another whole group are, I would say, firm like role-playing game stores. And, of course, there's a good number that rely heavily on the Games Workshop products. But there are quite a few that are tried and true historical wargaming stores throughout many states, and I feel that Massachusetts actually has quite a few. I'm lucky because where I'm based out of, I am maybe a half an hour drive to one store called the Hobby Bunker. It's right outside on the outskirts of Boston.
I've heard of it.
It is one of the best historical wargaming stores I've ever seen in my life. And then there's another one kind of in the center of the state, The Wiz, which is fantastic. And then if you go right over the border into New Hampshire, there's another one, an independent store that actually operates out of this guy's house. He has a double-wide garage that is his storefront called Adler Hobby. And they're all heavily focused on historical wargaming. I mean, we have tons of others. I could just go off for like 20 minutes on a list of all these places, Battleground Games and Hobbies and so forth, all these different places that have tons of it. But you're right, for many parts of the country here in the States, there are not a whole lot of game stores. And when I first got started, I did all my gaming in a game store because the ones close to me were fantastic. And one day I was talking with Stephen McLaughlin, who is now employed by Battlefront, but he was the head honcho beforehand of the WWPD podcast. And I was shocked when he told me that him and his buddies don't play games at their game store. And now my life is kind of flip-flopped, where the gaming I do with my friends, we do at my house. We get together about once a month, and we go down into the Wargaming Recon Center, as I call it, and play whatever on our table. But for many years, I was going every week or often, actually. You could tell this was during my college days, but every night I would go to the game store, and I'd get there, and I'd play games for a good 8 to 12 hours and wander home and be in bed by 4 or 5 in the morning. And it was glorious, but most people have never been able to do something like that. And it's really nice to hear that this is changing.
One of the things that I noticed when we were in the States is how much bigger your houses are than ours, but primarily the land that you've got around it. So you can build, we call them sheds over here, but it's kind of like a wooden structure in the building, in the garden, where you could put your war games table.
Yeah.
Here, we're a very small island, and land is, they're mean with land when you buy a house. You get a plot which is just about big enough to put a book of stamps on. So it's, you've got to be lucky to have a spare room or maybe a garage or something like that, which you can convert into a war game room. I mean, I'm lucky. I've got a 10-foot by 6-foot table. So
that's huge.
I've outgrown it. That's the problem. I always start a period with the best intentions, that I'm going to restrict this to skirmish. I'm going to maybe have 100 figures aside, and that's it. But then I think, well, I've got to have those, and I've also got to have those, and wouldn't it be nice to have an extra regiment of those or whatever it is? And then before I know it, I can't fit them on the table anymore. I mean, like my Zulus are crazy. I've got Islandwana 1-5. So that means I've got 5,000 Zulus. Now, if you try and get 5,000 Zulus onto a 10-foot by 6-foot table, there's not any room for the British. You've got to set them up in somebody else's garden. So, which is not ideal, because our weather is not very predictable. So it's not that... I've always found it incredibly hard to stick to point systems and things like that. I'll look at army lists and think, well, I want all of them. So I end up getting all of them, painting all of them up, and then finding that it's impossible to play them unless I've got a 30-foot table, which is not practical in England. And, even clubs can't really cope with that kind of size table. So, I haven't learned. I've been doing it for years and years and years, and I still haven't learned. So I guess I should learn by now.
Well, this is a perfect transition to talk about your new book, of all things. Of course, the new book is called Mega War Games, Big Battles in Miniature, and it's put out by War Games Illustrated. I have to say that even talking about your book, is interesting and weird for me, going back to that kind of surreal out-of-body experience for me, for a few reasons. First of which, when I started podcasting way back in, I guess it was 2005, 2006, I would never have been able, one, to get a guest like you on. It was just me talking into a microphone and hoping someone out there was interested enough in what I was doing to hear what I was saying. Never mind the fact that a company like War Games Illustrated, which, I mean, they're huge. Now, I'm so thankful that they sent me this review copy of it so that I could have time to look through it and absorb it and enjoy it before chatting with you. And again, when I started, anything I wanted to cover, I had to scrimp and save and hope that I had money after paying my college loans and stuff to be able to buy so that, and I still do buy, I would say, 80% of the stuff that I talk about on the show, but that other 20%, it makes life a little bit easier. So I am just so grateful to be able to be a recipient of that and very appreciative of the folks at War Games Illustrated and Battlefront that they had given this review copy. But also, I was really interested in this for another reason. I've talked about on the show a little bit in the past, maybe a couple of years, of starting to attend gaming conventions here in the States and starting to run events at some of these conventions. And they don't compare to the stuff that is covered in the Mega War Games book, and they don't compare at all to what you do at the War Game Holiday Center, which I know we're going to talk about a little later in the show. They're very moderate and in many ways very old school. But looking at the kind of stuff that you do cover in Mega War Games, it's great inspiration. Because who doesn't love to look at, whether it's a magazine, an article online, or a book that has these beautiful models that are just superbly painted on this nice big table with the wonderful terrain, and go, oh, I like that eye candy, and I wish that maybe someday I too could do that, or if I can't do that, at least to play in a game like that. So let's talk about the book a little bit. You mentioned a little bit ago about Joe Deaver being involved with this, and I know Ron Ringrose is also involved with it. So how did this come to be? How did this start?
Well, funnily enough, Joe Deaver bought a, this is going to sound really strange, he bought a 28mm scale trawler, model trawler, off Ron Ringrose via eBay. And because he was running this weird thing, he had a U-boat in 28mm scale built for him or something, and it was something, some attack on some German U-boat pen war game which he'd been planning for ages and ages and ages, and Ron happened to have this trawler for sale. Heaven knows where he got the trawler from or anything. I'm not sure about all the internets. All is a little bit odd. But suffice to say, Joe Deaver went to collect this trawler that he bought off eBay and saw Ron Ringrose's collection, and his jaw hit the floor because this guy has got everything. He's one of these, Ron's a lovely guy. He's retired, and he's one of a group that I would probably best describe them as being cash rich, time poor. So he's got money that he can put into his hobby, but he doesn't have, he would prefer to spend the time that he has for his hobby in actually playing the games rather than sitting down underneath a lamp and painting soldiers. And he's got a fantastic eye for making terrain and buildings and trees and all that kind of stuff. But he doesn't actually like painting soldiers. And I think he'd probably be one of the first to say that he's probably not a brilliant painter. He's a good painter, but he's not a brilliant painter. So he'd much rather have somebody do it for him. So he's built up this collection over a period of years. And it was just being played by, you know, like half a dozen people were seeing this collection, and it was vast. And Joe said to him, you know, we need to bring this collection out into the open, and, you know, people need to see it. And there's been a few articles in War Games Illustrated which have featured his collection. But what we really wanted to do is we wanted to put together a book which showcased his stuff, plus was actually useful to wargamers, because it's fine to have a nice coffee table eye candy book with lots and lots of pictures of soldiers and that kind of thing, but you know, and you can prop it up against on your workbench and sort of try and replicate some of the stuff. But what we wanted to try and do was to try and tell you how you can do it. I wanted it to be practical. So the text isn't your standard, you know, this is the history of the Battle of Waterloo. Oh, and by the way, you can do this for wargaming in the last paragraph. I wanted it to be a lot more practical than that. So I hope I've kind of, I was involved with it over a period of about a year. We did a photo shoot once a month or once every 6 weeks for a year and built up, I think Joe took around 400 or 500 photographs for every single chapter. Now in the book, you've got around 40, I think around about 40 photographs per chapter. But the exciting thing is that all of the extra photographs that Joe took aren't going to go to waste because they're, Dan Falconbridge at War Games Illustrated, who's been kind of like the driving force behind it on the publisher's side. I know he's, very far ahead now with the plans to release the digital version of it. And the digital one will have, photographs that you can swipe with your finger and you get an extra half dozen photographs. So, you know, that they're unpublished ones which aren't actually in the book. Plus, there's some fantastic, and I've never seen this before, they've taken photographs, 360-degree photographs, so you can spin a vignette of soldiers, you know, a command group or something like that, and you can spin it round and you can see it from every angle, which is wonderful. Plus, they've done this, they fixed wires above the war games and put a camera on it and moved the camera along the wire, so you've got kind of, I don't know, it's sort of aerial kind of views of the table. And it's remarkable what you can see. But I've seen a lot of the early production versions of all of this stuff, which is going to come out in the digital one. But it's very exciting because it does actually make it a really valuable book to have on, you know, on your iPad or whatever, you know, rather than just have, you know, traditional old paper. So I'm quite excited about that.
One of the things that really struck me about the book was the battles that were chosen. I could tell that you were trying to pick, and I don't know who made the decision to make these particular choices, but you could tell that you're trying to pick a nice progression of battles to show how warfare changed throughout the ages. And that was something I really enjoyed, but I was also kind of curious about maybe what battles that were discussed about including that just didn't make the cut for whatever reason.
Right. The ancient, there's several periods that he's got which didn't make the cut, mainly because we were restricted in terms of how many chapters we could have and the extent of the book. So we kind of shot for 10 periods plus an extra chapter, you know, which you've seen, obviously, which is all about the construction of stuff. But the ones that didn't make the cut are things like ancient Greeks didn't make it, Indian Mutiny, which is a great shame because it's my favourite period, that didn't make it. He's got some other collections as well, French and Indian Wars I know he's got, First World War I think he has as well. So there's others, but I think, I mean, fingers crossed and everything, I think there's probably enough for a second one.
That's wonderful.
So, you know, I don't know how that will pan out, you know, but I know there's certainly enough material for a second one, and I think certainly Napoleonic could stand being revisited as well, because I know he has he can do Austerlitz and things like this. So, you know, we focused in the war game one, in the Mega War Games book, we focused on the Peninsula and on the Waterloo campaign. But I know he can do other parts of the Napoleonic period as well, which are equally as pretty.
Any time War Games Illustrated puts out a publication, I think anyone who's grabbed any of them comes to expect the beautiful images and the nice glossy pages. But of course, in the book, they stand out and they should. But one of the things that really stood out for me was your writing, because I felt that with each battle, you clearly and accessibly discussed the battle, its importance, and then how you went beyond that. You explained what tactics were used and implied how wargamers could use it. But I felt like by reading what you had written, that I wasn't just passively sitting there absorbing this material, but that I was actively involving in the actual battle as it's being played historically and being played across the tabletop, that it allowed me to participate. And not every piece of writing out there in the world grips people like that. So I was very excited by that.
I'm so pleased you said that, and thank you very much for that. That's very kind, and that was entirely my intention, because I didn't want it to be too formulaic, and I really wanted it, because there's been a trend for years and years and years, particularly in war game magazines, of being presented with a very bland historical kind of treaty on, you know, a particular period or a particular battle, and then having just a line or two at the end, and, you know, such and such a manufacturer makes soldiers or whatever, and, you know, you could use these set of rules or something, and it's got no, it's not really a war game article, it's a historical, it's kind of like a potted history article, you know, which doesn't have any real meaning for a wargamer, and that used to turn me off magazines, you know. And I mean, there was a period for all of them, all, you know, War Games Illustrated, Miniature War Games, they've all been through that, and Battle Magazine before that, they've all gone through that kind of simplistic kind of way, you know, we'll tell them about the period, and that might interest them in buying some soldiers, you know, but it doesn't work for me. It annoys me. So I didn't want to, and I only had 3,000 words per chapter, you know. So I wanted to really make them work.
I noticed that, and of course this had to be intentional, but I noticed that the imagery really matched what you had written for each page. That they just worked so well together, as blended together. You weren't talking about such and such a thing, and then have a picture of something completely unrelated on the same page.
Yeah.
That,
well,
building is important.
I was fortunate in the sense that I had access to all the photographs which Joe had taken, and I had them on a second laptop, looking at them while we were doing the text. So I actually chose each of the every photograph in the book. I chose it because I wanted it to illustrate something in particular. You know, obviously, when you scan through, when you scan through 400 photographs, some of them are going to work and some of them aren't going to work. You know, and so it actually, the whole process of paring down, you know, to 10% basically of the total number of photographs which Joe had taken was a pretty tough job, you know, and I did that in relation to what I was writing. So, you know, I'm glad you noticed. I'm glad you noticed the care that we'd taken in choosing the right photographs. Hopefully, we have chosen the right photographs.
I know that you've written, well, you and your wife have written, I think, combined over, what is it, 240, 250 books?
So sure, we have.
You have an extensive knowledge of history in general and military history. But I was kind of curious where you went to gain information for each of the battles that you wrote about, because no person can be an expert on everything. So you had to have had some sort of sources that you maybe kept on finding yourself referring to talk about such and such battle. For example, the battle you refer to in the book as Stillwater, which I'm ashamed to say threw me for a loop at first until I realized you're talking about the First Saratoga.
Or Freeman's Farm.
Yes.
it's actually Joe and Ron call it Stillwater. You have to sort of bear in mind, of course, that that the American Revolution or the American War of Independence or even I've had it referred to as the first American Civil War, and as we might refer to it over here, it has a different kind of ring to it than perhaps you Americans view it. You know, so we do call the battles slightly different things, and we do place slightly different emphasis on the importance of each of the battles and that kind of thing. So it's a cultural thing, I think, which is why it's called Stillwater. But to answer your question about the references to stuff, there are a few battles which I could probably bore you for several hours on just off the top of my head, like Gettysburg, like Waterloo, and various other ones, you know, and I wouldn't have to even, you could blindfold me and everything, and I wouldn't need to look at a single thing, and I could keep on, you know, talking about them. There are others which foxed me. Battle of Coriolano, for example, the one that's based in Italy. I went direct to the U.S. Divisional History to find out about that. You know, and I read around all of the various situation reports and after battle reports that were written by officers and guys which had actually fought in that action. So I would use those as my primary source. Whenever I possibly can, I would go back to a primary source. Little difficult when you're talking about, the Battle of Narbonne, because I my Latin is not that great. Plus, I don't think there's many sit reps written by Roman generals. Not that I'm aware of.
Me neither.
No,
that must have been a challenge.
Yeah, I like a challenge. I like a challenge. I like the I like the discipline of having to be brief. I mean, there are some jobs which, you know, that we do, and they've got really, really tight word counts. You know, you've really got to be bang on. You know, if they say 3,500 words, it's 3,500 words, not a word more. But you know, so that has kind of trained us to, you know, to be brief and to be, you know, not to waste a word. You know, not so much when I'm talking, because when I talk, I can go on a little bit. So please excuse me.
I understand exactly what you mean. When I was back in school, I used to write for the school paper, and our advisor used to have this thing she would say over and over again, that we needed to write tight, which is something I've struggled with all my life, because both in speech and in written word, I tend to be a little loquacious. So I could spend 10, 15 pages, say, on a term paper trying to answer a simple question, and I'm trying to coerce you is really what I'm trying to do, to agree with whatever I'm saying, whether it's right or wrong. So getting something to be succinct is not a skill I possess, but I admire those who can do that.
Well, on the flip side of that, if you're being paid per word, you have to work on the maxim that why say in a sentence what you can say in a paragraph.
That's true.
So you know, it depends on the job.
I think, in case listeners haven't gotten the impression yet, that I'm just going to come out and say it, that your book, Mega War Games, is one that people need to buy. You explained all the wonderful things about it, and hopefully that gives people a taste why they should buy it. But if for whatever reason that isn't enough of a reason, on my previous episode, every year I do a holiday gift guide to give my recommendations for
things. Listen to that.
And the book Mega War Games was my number one pick for under $50 in value, and one of my top picks overall for what people should buy. I try not to always pick books because it can be hard, and books are expensive, and it's hard for people to justify spending the money on a book when they also need to either make or buy the terrain and the models and the paint and all the other stuff that goes into the thing we call wargaming. But this is one of those books that I think is very important for wargamers to get. Like you said, it's not just a coffee table book where you're going to look at it and go, oh, isn't that nice? Maybe someday I'll do that. Doing a large battle, any of the large battles in this book, can be daunting. But the key term that I would have to say that comes across in reading this book is accessible. You manage to take something, you and Ron and Joe, you manage to take something that is so daunting and not accessible at all for most people. Like you said, most people don't have the space in their houses to do this, whether they live in the States or the UK or wherever you are, to have these thousands and thousands and thousands of Zulu or whatever it is. But I think many of us have that desire to do something just to create a spectacle.
I think the one word that I would use to describe it is aspirational.
Yes.
You know, because you can recreate this, that kind of spectacle, whether you're using 6mm soldiers or whether you're using 28mm soldiers, it doesn't matter. You know, it's doing all of the little extra things. You know, for a long time, you know, when I used to go to war game clubs quite a lot, you used to play on something that looked like I was going to use the term cricket pitch, but that's probably quite meaningless. A pool table. You know, you just play on something absolutely flat as a pancake, no hills. You know, one or two little plastic trees and a building stuck somewhere, and that kind of thing. And the two armies would just line up and charge one another. And you know, and that's fine for a 3 or 4 hour game. You know, and it's amusing, you can have fun, it's social, and all of those things, all of the things that we love about wargaming. But it doesn't take a lot of extra work to do a little bit more, you know, to put little vignettes on the table, you know, of some guys being, you know, a field dressing station or a couple of messengers on horseback charging across the table or something like that. And I think that's, if you look at the photographs in Ron's collection, you'll always see somewhere there's something going on. You know, not soldiers marching along with muskets over their shoulders or tanks rumbling across the table, but in the background there'll be some guy stood there with a hoe or somebody chasing some geese or something like that. There'll be something weird going on. And that's the kind of little bits of additional kind of eye candy that make it a real landscape.
Well, you know? It breathes some life into it.
I think so. I think so. Because I think a lot of war games can be quite sterile.
Yes.
You know, the battle is actually happening in some kind of completely isolated environment. Where there isn't wildlife, where there isn't civilians wandering around and that kind of thing, or buildings, even having a house with a door open, you know, just a simple little thing like that. You know, don't button all your doors up on your wargame buildings, just leave a door open, you know, or a window open or something like that, because it just infers that somebody's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's those sort of things, you know. But, you know, it's wargaming is what it is. You know, it's different to every, you know, for everybody, and everybody has a completely different spin on it.
I think it was last year, my friends and I, we ran an event at a local gaming convention down in Mansfield, Massachusetts, called TotalCon. I talked about it a fair amount on the show, the convention in general, but also the game. And we ran, our event was the Battle of Freeman's Farm using mm-hmm. black powder rules. And whenever we've run something, we try to do something to make it a little more special. We don't mm-hmm. necessarily have the time to devote to doing all those cool little neat extra things like having, you know, the farmer chasing his geese or whatever the case would be. And our table tends to look very old school. We have the green felt, but we do use things like, say, tents, or there'll be houses or trees and that sort of stuff.
We try
to add a little drama into it. So, for example, for last year, there's a turning point in the battle for whether or not the British troops will get reinforcements and where they will come on. And it's contingent on a certain thing happening with the American forces. So I had created these little messenger, like courier notes. I printed them out on the computer and I made them look like they were kind of crinkled and old parchment. So they were rolled up with a ribbon and I had them in my bag at the convention. And one I would pull out if A happened and one if B happened. So as the kids are playing the game and it's going on and the key moment comes, I'm like, oh, hold on a second. So I reach into my bag, I pull it out. I'm like, General, we got this message for you. And so I'm like, you got to read it aloud. And the people read it aloud. It's stupid and it's maybe goes a little too far into that whole role playing kind of thing. But that kind of drama, that's something extra, whether it's having the
I love all of that. And I try and, as much as I possibly can, I try and inject that kind of thing into what we do in Crete as well. You know, I don't like to have predictable games, and I don't like any of the gamers to think that they've got it licked or they've got their opponent licked right until the last minute. So I'll always throw stuff in. I guess I'm fortunate that there's always a box of soldiers which aren't on the table.
That is fortunate.
And I've heard some terrific little ruses that people can use. I mean, there's a guy I know. They were playing a war game and he had two boxes. His opponent had seen him unload all of his soldiers, and there were these two boxes which had not been opened, and they were sitting by the side, and he thought, oh, that's reinforcements. That's got to be reinforcements. And he never went to those boxes throughout the entire war game, but he was aware that those boxes could contain more reinforcements. In actual fact, they were empty. I think war gamers have probably, you know, you probably talked about this before, but war gamers have got this all-seeing eye. You know, we're floating over the battlefield and we can see everything. We know to the nth degree how what the morale is of each of the units which we're facing, and we know how we can figure out precisely how long it will take them to march to a particular crossroads or whatever it might be. So all of those things we know much more than the generals would possibly know, which is why I like black powder. You mentioned black powder. Black powder is one of those sets of rules that bring the uncertainty back into wargaming. You know, there was a period in the 80s and 90s where you could measure things precisely and you'd know exactly how it was going to go, and it was very much like a game of chess, but with lots more pieces. Games like Black Powder and I do like Richard Clarke's stuff, you know, the Two Fat Lardies stuff, you know, with the turning cards and not knowing for certain whether you're going to move your men and all of those sorts of things. I like those random factors, you know, which can it adds a bit of jeopardy to it and a bit of excitement to it, and you know, and it's not predictable. You know, the worst thing in the world is to play a predictable war game, you know, because your heart kind of sinks after the, you know, second or third go, and you think, have I really got to do this for another 6 hours?
There have been times in my past, and I hate to say it, and hate to knock on them, but when I would have been playing a Games Workshop game, and you put down your army on the table after you figured out the points and stuff, and you look at what your opponent's playing, and before anything happens, the dice is rolled, you know that because they made choices to include this type of unit and that type of unit, that you're not going to win, or that it's going to be so much harder. And I've seen the same thing with other games like War Machine and Hordes, that because if you don't use this particular model, then good luck to you. Why are you even bothering to play? I think you should always have that chance to try to, that maybe if you do well enough and if the dice rolls go well enough, that there's hope that maybe you'll win. For me, it's not really about the winning, it's about having the fun. But if there's no hope of achieving your goal, it's very hard for people to have fun.
You can also look at the table and say that's where the firefight's going to happen.
That's true.
You know, that's, you know, he's going to move this, you know, X, Y, and Z up to this point, and I'm going to be battering my head against a brick wall to bust through that for the rest of the game. You know, and you know that.
I've enjoyed talking with you about the Mega War Games book, but I was hoping that maybe you might be able to have a chance to talk with your incredible wife. I'm really intrigued about her column that's appeared in a couple magazines, The Continuing Tales of a War Games Widow.
Mm-hmm. No problem. I shall pass you over to her now.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Diane. It is truly an honor to have you here on Wargaming Recon.
Oh, very kind. Thank you very much.
As I was telling your husband,
nice to be with you.
Well, I've been looking forward to chatting with the both of you for ages. It feels like ages. And I think I first kind of learned of both of you and the wonderful things that you've been doing because of you and your column, that I came into it by reading older issues of Battle Games magazine. And I think the first one that you appear in is episode 13. And
13 is the one, yeah.
I have it in front of me. It's called Bags of Potential, The Life and Times of a War Games Widow. I was just so drawn into it. It's so enjoyable to read. And Henry's referred to you as having, Henry Hyde, that is, of being the owner of the most famous hands in wargaming. That's an attribute I really enjoy. I don't know if it's one that you like as well, but...
It's true, actually, because we went to Crisis, you know, in Belgium, the war game show. Tin Soldiers of Antwerp run last month, and I was very much in the background because John and Joe and Ron were launching Mega War Games, and a man sidled up to me and said, "Excuse me, but are you Diane Sutherland?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I thought so, I recognised your hands." So I think it's Henry likes me when we go to any war game shows. Henry likes me to wear bright red because that's the old Battle Games magazine colour.
Yep.
So I wear bright red nail varnish as I did when we went to Crisis. So I think probably the nail varnish struck people rather than the shape of the hands.
You'll have to get them insured.
It's a very light-hearted article. And we tend to, as I'm making stuff at home, John takes photographs of my hands, and mainly because I usually look an absolute mess, and I've got paint splattered all over me and things like that. So we restrict it to the hands, and it's just become something that we just do now. You know, he doesn't take photographs of anything other than me working with my hands. So that's why I'm very famous.
That first article, when I started to read it, I wasn't really sure what I was going to get in there. I think I was expecting something more of a, oh, your husband's off playing games, and this is what you do to pass your time. But instead, I got something even better. You're in the trenches, you're doing all this work, and you're creating wonderful things. And I remember there was one point, I was reading one of the articles, and there's this picture of you. I think it was when you were working on the tables for the War Game Holiday Center in Crete.
Yes.
And I thought, wait a sec, she's doing all this work. It's in all of these articles. What the heck is he doing?
He's usually having a panic in the background, to be honest. No, I mean, when we're in Crete, we work together in the cellar, as we call it. It's a very nice cellar. It's not as it sounds. But we work together to strip table and rebuild the table for the next game and stuff like that. But when we're there, before we open for the season, we make lots of stuff on site, because, you know, we leave everything over there. We don't bring it back every time. So we've got opportunity to make new pieces of terrain or like the port that appeared in one of the, I don't know, the miniature war games magazines, the Spanish port.
Yep.
We built that while we were over there, and, you know, and islands and loads of stuff we do while we're in Crete. And it's quite nice because, you know, we can just leave it there and store it away and get it out again when we go back. So, so there are some photographs of me in the cellar in Crete, and there are photographs of me in the garage, and there are photographs of me at my dining room table. It depends on whether I'm inside or outside. No, it's very enjoyable. Having known nothing whatsoever about war games until John and I got together in 2000, I've learned a great deal in the last 13 years.
I'm sure most war gamers, as you know, tend to be men. And like me, I would hope that many of them who are with someone, that their significant other is at least tolerant, if not understanding, of what they do. And my wife, she tries to understand, and she's very, very supportive of all of this craziness that is called wargaming.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not at the point where she's going to be the one creating a port or painting a giant table with me. So I think it's something that wargamers really enjoy seeing, that you are so supportive of John and that you have this interest in it, because it doesn't matter how supportive of him that you are or how much you love him. If you didn't care about any of this stuff, you wouldn't be doing it.
And no, I wouldn't do it if I didn't care about it. It's just grown on me, really. I mean, I started off not having any idea whatsoever what they do. It was like, you know, foreign language to me. But then when I realized, particularly with the bags of potential, it's a very, very well-known phrase in our household, bags of potential, because my sons both bring unwanted items, if you like.
Yeah.
To the house, and John, we thought this might have bags of potential. And so once I started to realize what he was hoping to achieve, I could then maybe see in a clearer way how to get there than John can, if that doesn't sound arrogant. But he will sort of say to me, I want it to look like this, and he'll perhaps show me a photograph of something or do a sketch or something like that, and he can't seem to fathom how to get from A to B to what he wants, but I can usually come up with something that's kicking around in the kitchen or, you know, out in the greenhouse. Or I mean, sharks is something that comes to mind. He wanted sharks for our pirate game.
Okay.
In Crete, and he said, I want sharks, but they're going to have to lay flat on the war game table, which we painted blue, and then I varnished the whole damn thing and went round it with a carrier bag, scrunched up, dipped in paint for waves and things like that. He said, but they've got to lay flat. Well, we were racking our brains. Cardboard wasn't a good idea because they get damaged too easily when you've got lots of players playing lots of games. And I went out to the greenhouse for something. And there were some little clips that you used to tie plants to the greenhouse to like canes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were fin shaped.
Oh.
And I came in with them, and he went into raptures because I'd found a shark for him. So it's all. I mean, I now, when I go shopping, I now have one eye open that is looking for something with bags of potential.
What you and I would call bags of potential, for just for any of the non-war gamers who might be listening to the show, most the average person would refer to it as trash. I think you and I would agree on that. Yeah. And I can say that as someone right behind me. In our home, we have a 3-bedroom house, but I took one of the bedrooms to be our office / mm-hmm. my podcast studio. And behind me, I have rubbish. I have trash, or you and I would say bags of potential, of things mm-hmm. for different projects. Mostly like cereal boxes and all sorts of like thin card or even thicker cardboard, because I could use it for bases or something, or I might not have an idea yet, but someday the idea might hit me. And if I don't have the stuff just in case, well, then all will be lost. But if I have it, I'm prepared just in case.
Just in case. That's right. Yeah, I mean, packaging material from anything that you buy, you know, the polystyrene, the white or sometimes black polystyrene. We've made loads of things out of that. Yard brooms.
Mm-hmm.
You use bristles from yard brooms. We're about to embark on a zeppelin.
Oh, wow. Is this for Darkest Africa?
Yes.
Okay.
And hot air balloons.
Okay.
So, I think the actual balloon for the hot air balloon is fine. It's a little basket that we're puzzling over at the moment. But no doubt we'll come up with something fairly soon. But yes, it's I don't war game. I don't know. I mean, I could probably follow rules, if you know what I mean. I could get by. If John needed a spare pair of hands in the cellar, I'd go down and do it. But I haven't done it before, and I don't paint soldiers because I just do not have either the eyesight or the patience to do what John does. I tried to paint a goat, that's it. I tried to paint a goat, and it ended up looking like an alien. So I chose not to do any more.
Well, when you're doing all the other stuff, you each have your strengths, and it's good that you're supportive of each other and you play to those strengths.
That's the same, actually, when we're dressing the table, because it is a huge table. It takes us all day to take one game down and put the next game up. And John knows exactly where everything should go from a historical point of view. So he's, in his mind's eye, he's got the map of the battle. But I tend to place the trees and the buildings so that they look like when we do the Battle of Crete, 1941, the German invasion of Crete. When we first did it, John put the villages at ground level. And I said no, because Greek villages are always up in the mountains. So we look at it from two different points of view, if you see what I mean. But fortunately, those points of view complement each other. And strange things. John will say, well, you know, where do you think this looks best? And I'll often sort of say, well, I like the table like that, but I prefer it with the houses here, or no, surely some of them would be on the other side of the road as well. And that's just a woman's point of view, really. You know, I think we sort of see the table slightly differently. It's got to look pretty for a woman.
Well, one of the things I've learned the hard way, some friends and I, we, for the past few years, we've put on events, games really, at local gaming conventions. And one of the things I had to learn the hard way was that something may have been a certain way, arranged a certain way historically, and maybe it makes more sense for how, like on paper, how it should look, that you should have the trees right here and the buildings here. But for playability, it may not work that way. You might need to exaggerate things and spread them out a little bit more or move them around. Or like how you said, just for appearance's sake, it might look better. And that's all part of the experience.
That's right. That's what happened when we were designing the, or devising the pirate game. We got some really beautiful ships from Ainsty Castings. I put them all together, and we had to make sails for them. Well, should I say I had to make sails for them? But you couldn't have a full-length sail from the top of the mast to the bottom of the mast because you wouldn't be able to get your hand in to move soldiers about inside the ships. So we had to roll them up. You know, and they would have looked probably much, much better if the sails were fully out. But, you know, you've got to think of practicalities. If somebody, you know, maybe a guy with big hands trying to get his hands underneath the sails. So we had to, you know, you have to think about things like that all the time, when, especially if we're over in Crete. I mean, it's not so bad if John is playing on his table, but here, but over in Crete, you've got to think of the practicalities of maybe 8 men around the table, all trying to access their soldiers. You've got to be careful that you leave vision space for, you know, firing and things like that, and for them to reach across and not knock things over, and, you know, it's all complicated. Or so John tells me, anyway.
I've seen too many times people, gamers, try to get a better view of how things look on the table, the model's view, and get it right down, putting the head right on the table right next to the model, and lo and behold, they get poked in the face because of a tree or something that they didn't pay attention to.
Well, we're very lucky in Crete. We have our war gamers are lovely people. They're really, really lovely. And most of them have now become friends. I mean, we're fortunate that this next year is our fourth year. And our Belgian war gamers are coming back for the fourth year on the trot. So, you know, it's a social thing as much as anything. And we enjoy their company, and it's not so much about the fact that they're customers. They've come to play a game that they love and eat food that they enjoy and see people that they get on very well with. So, you know, it's really nice. And we've got Danish people coming back as well for the second time, and we've got Australians coming back for the second time. And this year we've got two female wargamers. Last year we had our first lady wargamer, who was Australian. But this year she's coming back with her husband, and then we've got another female wargamer. So it'd be quite nice. They might tempt me to go down and have a go, I think. Next season I might see if I can take on somebody downstairs. We'll see.
I think it's a ringing endorsement when people come back time and time again to enjoy your services. And let's talk about the War Game Holiday Center down in Crete. John was telling me before we started recording that you are the go-to person for all the organizational kind of stuff. So why don't you explain to the listeners what the center is and how it works?
Okay. Well, the centre is based in a very small, quiet resort called Gouvez. And Gouvez is about 20 minutes car ride from Heraklion Airport, which is on the island of Crete. My jobs while we're over there, as I've already said, are to dismantle one game and help John set up the next game. But I also am a taxi driver, because I go and collect people from the airport and bring them to the apartments. And then when on their day of departure, I take them back to the airport. Some people, because they war game for 4 days out of the seven or whatever, maybe 14 days that they're there, like to do excursions, which I help them to book, or they might want to hire a car and drive around. We recommend places to eat. We've had some people who've had walking difficulties, which means that I tend to take them to the restaurant, or we take them out with us of an evening so that they don't have to walk too far. We take them in the car. The apartment owners are very, very long-standing friends of ours. Mary used to live in our local town, but then met Andoni when she was in Crete on holiday, and they eventually got married. That was about 21 years ago. And I've been going to Crete every year since then. So she was my friend in England before she moved over to Crete. And fortunately, John loves Crete as well and gets on very, very well indeed with Mary and Andoni. So I'm very fortunate that I can continue that annual trip. It's just that it's extended itself to 2-3 months a year now rather than 4 or 5 weeks. So the apartments belong to Mary and Andoni. They've got 10 apartments. They sleep a maximum of 3 adults, or 2 adults and 2 children under the age of 12. They've got a sitting room, a twin bedroom, bathroom and kitchen. And they've got 2 balconies, one at the front and one at the back. So you've always got sun and you've always got shade. And they all overlook a very, very nice infinity swimming pool with sunbeds and umbrellas. And then the War Game Holiday Centre is underneath Mary's Taverna, which has a very nice veranda where you take your breakfast, because our guests are there on a bed and breakfast basis. And she does excellent food. Drinks are available all day. She does evening meals if people choose to eat there. If not, there are several tavernas within walking distance. And the beach is about a 7-minute walk away, just down one straight road. So it's a bus stop is virtually outside. We can arrange car hire. We can arrange excursions. And it's a very, very informal, friendly, family-style atmosphere.
It sounds wonderful.
It is very, very nice. It's lots of fun as well. It's lots of fun because people are there doing what they want to do, with or without their significant others. You know, we get lots of guys come on their own, but we also get quite a few wives and children. There's lots for the wives or girlfriends and children to do. The beach is within easy distance. There's an aquarium. There's a very interesting little, to say museum is the wrong term, but it's like a folklore museum. So it's all about how people lived in olden times in Crete, and it's very hands-on. The kids can have a go at crushing grapes, and they can have a go at making olive oil and touch all the herbs and sit in a shepherd's hut and do all things like that, which is very good for the children. They love it. And there are loads of nice places to just sort of wander to. There's markets, you know, street markets in Heraklion, which is easy to get to on the bus as well. I think that's the end of my advertisement for War Game Holiday Center.
Well, it's a good one, I have to say. Up here in New England, it's not officially winter, but it's winter. I think we're down to something like 32 degrees right now. So having that sun and, more importantly, the warmth is, I'm sure, of importance to people around here.
Well, we have had some Americans come to visit us. We had a couple and their granddaughter from just outside Washington, who we were very lucky to meet up with when we came over to America last year. And in fact, they took us on a tour of Arlington Cemetery, which I very much wanted to see. And we also had a couple from New Mexico, Albuquerque. So, and they were there at the same time, which is very strange, but they're the only Americans we've had, but they were there at the same time. And absolutely loved it, really enjoyed it. So if anybody out there can't make their mind up, it has been done already, successfully.
So let's pretend one of my listeners or myself or whoever is interested in coming, and I hope someone is. How does it work from booking on down? How many days do they get to stay? How much does it cost? What sort of options do they have? Or are these questions that John is better off answering?
No, I can answer them. You can basically come for as long as you want, and you can play as many war games as you want. If you were doing Europe, which is what the other Americans did, they did the couple from New Mexico did Amsterdam, and then they flew to Athens from Amsterdam, and then a domestic flight from Athens to Crete. The Australians did Venice and Budapest after they'd been to Crete. They're coming back next year and they're going to do Rome. So they're flying to Rome, spending time in Rome, and then there is a direct flight from Rome to Heraklion. So I wouldn't have thought anybody would want to come all the way from Australia or America for a week. So, you know, you could tie in other destinations in Europe. And there are quite a few direct flights to Heraklion, so you wouldn't have to do the Athens thing. You can arrive on a Monday, Tuesday, or Friday. The gaming days are Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday and Sunday. So you could do 8 days, you could do 4 days, you could do 2 days. If you just let us know in advance, and if somebody else is already booked, then you'd be playing what they've chosen to play. But if you're the first person to book, you decide what games you want to play. The wargaming is 100 English pounds. Just a minute.
Just under $70
US
dollars.
Right. John's just worked out $70 US to war game per day.
That's not bad. Everything's provided. You don't have to worry about the models or terrain or anything. That's wonderful.
You don't have to pack your soldiers away. You don't have to set anything up. You've even got dice to use, so you don't actually have to, you know, pay for anything to get to us. The apartments are 45 euros per night, per apartment. John's just going to work that out for us. 45 euros per night, per apartment. So if there were three adults, that's 15 euros per person, per night.
That sounds really cheap. I can't do the exchange in my head for the exchange rates, but that sounds incredibly...
Euros. $60. $60 per night per apartment.
Including breakfast.
And it's either English breakfast or scrambled egg on toast or, you know, I mean, whatever you wanted. There's cereals there. There's toast and jams, jellies, as you call it. Whatever you wanted.
That's an incredible deal. It really is. Whenever I've gone to... gaming conventions over here, even small ones, I'm paying over 100, 130 US a night with a convention discount, and that's still, that doesn't cover all the stuff that it covers to go see you guys down in Crete. That's amazing.
So even if two guys wanted to come, or husband and wife, whatever, or boyfriend, girlfriend, for two people in an apartment is $30 each a night. It's very cheap. And they're nice. They're basic Greek apartments, but you do have everything you need. You have a shower, towels are provided, bed linen's provided. There's all the crockery and cutlery and saucepans. There's a fridge. There's a small two-ring electric, if you want to cook something. There's a kettle. There's a TV. There's a settee, tables and chairs, inside and out. So, I mean, you have everything you need. They're not luxury, but they're typically Greek, and they're cool. They're cool. Some of them have air condition. Some of them don't. But the downstairs ones really don't need it because they're enclosed, if you know what I mean. They've got, they haven't got many exposed walls. So, you know, they keep very cool. The upstairs ones have got air conditioning. And as I say, you've got two very nice sized verandas, enough to seat six people round a table easily to eat. Both of them. So, you know, you've got plenty of outside space as well. And there's, I mean, the swimming pool is free and the sunbeds are free and the umbrellas are free for apartment guests. And there's drinks available all day long.
It's sounding like a version of paradise for war gamers. It really is.
Sun, sand, and soldiers.
Exactly. Yeah, someplace beautiful, and you're able to play a few games and have some fun and maybe a few beverages with people.
Mm. Yeah, we've got quite a good selection of games available now. Every year we've added a couple more. So the first year we started off with Crete, 1941, because it was the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Crete. And then we've got American Civil War. We do Gettysburg, Chancellorsville, one more.
Antietam.
Should remember that because we went there last year. We've got Indian Mutiny as a two-day or a one-day game. We've got the Pirate Game, which is usually a two-day game, although if people wanted, they could play it for one day. We've got the French and Indian Wars. The Battle of Hastings is one of our new ones for this year. And we've got Normandy 1944. The Darkest Africa is another new one for this year, which is why I've got dinosaurs staring at me at the moment. And there's another one. What else is it? French and Indian Wars. Rorke's Drift and Isandwana. Isandwana and Rook's Drift.
That's so, a lot of games.
It's a lot of games, it's a lot of soldiers. It's, but it, every single time we walk away from a brand new table, we make a change of some description. You know, the first time you set it up, the people who came over for our test week before we opened to the general public just to get feedback from guys who knew what they were talking about were Joe Deva, Jervis Johnson,
Dave Ryan
from Caliber Books, and Theophanis, who's a Greek war gamer. And when they came over, they played the Battle of Crete and they played Indian Mutiny. But if they were to come again this year, they'd look totally different because we've added so much stuff and it sort of made extra pieces of this and made the bridge look different. And, you know, all sorts of little tweaks, new regiments have been added. So, yeah. And the guy, what was his name? Tom, who came from Dunloren, just outside Washington, sent us some, and quite a few actually, Ju-52s for the Crete game. So we've got more airplanes now than we did have to start with. So, you know, it's just, it just constantly evolves. which is nice. It's nice. And we walk away from the table and look back, and we'll sort of look at each other and nod as if to say, yeah, we're happy with that.
So what you're saying is someone could come every year, play the exact same game, but every year it would be different for them. It'd be like a new experience.
I think so. I think it's safe to say that. Certainly, if our test week people, if Joe were to come over, which he's threatening to do, actually, but if Joe were to come over, he probably wouldn't recognise the Creek game because we've just put so much more stuff on that table. It's a case of, it's not until you play it that you actually, John realises, we should have done this and it would have been better if we'd done that. For example, in the Rorke's Drift game, our Belgian customers played that last year for the first time. And we've got 750 to 1,000 Zulus for a one-day game. But obviously with Rorke's Drift, the British soldiers were vastly outnumbered. So John wrote the name of each British soldier that was actually at Rorke's Drift on the base of his soldiers. And they got quite emotional. Our war gamers got quite emotional because they felt as if they'd got to know these little men.
Yeah.
See what I mean? And one of the reviews that one of them said was that it was awesome to actually get really protective about the guys that you were shepherding. Do you know what I mean? Because they've got a name. Weird, isn't it?
It makes it feel more real and authentic.
And I think everybody knows the story of Rorke's Drift so well because of Zulu.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, Michael Caine is there. And, you know, they sort of felt as if they knew these little guys.
It's lovely, really.
It's
almost lovely. Like it's a friend, you know, someone you went down to the pub with or someone you work
with. Yeah, somebody you spent the whole day with. You know,
it makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I don't know if he's planned to do that on any of the other things. I suppose you could do that on Hastings, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, we're busy getting everything ready. Just got to come across, find a solution to the basket for the hot air balloons.
That's wonderful.
I'm sure something will happen. It'll be an article anyway when we finally decide. That will go in miniature war games.
When people decide that they want to come to the War Game Holiday Center, how do they book the events? Are there certain days and time of year that you're there? And how do they get in touch with you?
Well, we've got a website, which is www.wargameholidays.com, and there's a contact us page. But if they had a look at the holidays page, it lists the dates we're open. We're open from June the 3rd until, we've sort of said end July, beginning of August. If anybody wanted the first or second week in August, we'd hang on. If nobody's interested, then we'd come home. The reason we tend not to open in August is it's school holidays for English kids, which makes the flights more expensive.
Ah.
And it does get very, very hot in August. Very, very hot. So it's not a popular time. June and July are fine. And the English school children don't break up until the last week of July. So June the 3rd we open. And we're there until nobody wants us anymore, really. There's a contact us page, and if they look at the holidays page, it will tell you what's already been booked. So we've got a couple of games booked from, I think, the 11th of June through till the end of June. Most gaming days are booked.
Okay.
But if nobody's already booked, then the first person to book that slot gets to choose what games, and the selection of games are on that page.
So just because something is booked, does that mean that there's no more room for people? Or
No, it doesn't mean there's no more room. It means that we can take up to about 8 at a time. Otherwise, John spins round and round because he umpires the game and people are constantly calling out to him, John, how far can I move these soldiers? And can I see that guy? Is that tree in the way? And if he's not careful, he's run, you know, more than 8 is difficult for him. And that's not the purpose of why we're there. We're there to enjoy ourselves, really. So we take 8 as a maximum. And I mean, John likes to spend time with the gamers. You know, he doesn't like to sort of hustle them along. He likes to make it relaxed and, you know, have a social side and a laugh and a joke and stop and go upstairs and get a beer or whatever. So it's 8 maximum. But, I mean, the fact that the game is up there as having been booked might mean there's only 2 or 3 booked that. So the best thing to do is look and see what you can make, what dates you can make, if anything's already been booked. If you're interested in those games, contact us and we'll get back to you to let you know whether or not we've got enough spaces in the room. And obviously we have to check that the apartments are empty because Mary and Anne Donnie don't just open for us. They have regular customers that come back year on year, so it's a case of whether there's a free apartment and whether there's enough room in the War Games room.
It sounds to me like if anyone's interested in having an incredible vacation of a lifetime down in Crete, they need to get onto your website sooner rather than later and get in touch with you to find out about what's available so that they can book their holiday.
Well, I mean, the nice thing about coming over there is that Crete is absolutely amazing in itself. I mean, Crete is a beautiful island. It really, really is. And it's got so much history attached to it. You know, all within a 15-20 minute drive, you know, you've got the Palace of Knossos, you've got the Palace of Malia, you've got stunning scenery, very, very quaint, typically Greek villages, you know, all very laid back. And you certainly know you're on holiday when you're in Crete. It's so chilled out. It's amazing. I mean, I've been gone for 20 plus years and I still absolutely adore it. Absolutely adore Crete. So it's not just the War Games Centre and it's not just Mary and Andoni's lovely hospitality and nice apartments. It's Crete itself that is very much worth visiting and having a good look around. You know, which is why lots of people tend to come for 2 weeks to the apartments, but just to War Games for, you know, like 1 week. 4 days out of 1 week, because that gives them a chance to, you know, see some of the island and experience Crete, which I would recommend to everybody.
It sounds so wonderful. It really does.
Yeah. It really is. Crete is astounding. It is a very, very enjoyable experience being in Crete. It's like the second home to me now. And you know, I still get a huge buzz when we're about to land. Although this year we're going to drive, believe it or not, we're going to drive to Crete from England.
I never knew that was possible.
Well, it is possible, yeah, because there's we can do the tunnel under the North Sea. Mm-hmm. We can do that, and then we need to get a ferry from Italy to Northern Greece, and then drive from Patras, which is northern Greece, down to Piraeus, which is near Athens, the port of Athens, and then we get another ferry across to Heraklion. So it'll take us about 4 days to do it in total, but 2 overnights on ferries. So, but it'll be good. That means we'll have our car there, and it's a nice four-wheel drive car, so it's got lots of room and plenty of space in the boot for our customers' baggage when I collect them at the airport. And it's you know, it's something we're accustomed to, and it'll be an adventure in itself. Just have to allow a week, really, to get there so that we're not late for anybody.
But we'll be there at the end of May. You're going to have a nice trip before you even get there.
On the way back, we might spend a bit of time in the Peloponnese, you know, northern Greece.
Mm-hmm.
We might spend two or three nights there and have a look around, because neither of us have seen that part of Greece before. Have a look at Mycenae and all those lovely places, the Corinth Canal. That'll be good. Yes.
Maybe one of these days you guys will see me down in Crete at the Holiday Center.
I think that would be absolutely wonderful if you could make it. You'd be more than welcome, and we'd really very much like to see you.
I'll have to put it onto my list. I was telling John about my bucket list, and one of my bucket list items for my show was to have both of you on the show, so I'm able to cross that off, and now I can add another item on to come and see you guys in person and playing some fun games.
Okay, or if you come to England, you'd only have to give us a call.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah, we're on the east coast of England. So you'd feel at home because you're on the east coast of America.
I am.
Yes, I think we're going to be in the States again in April. But we've sort of half-made plans. My cousin lives in Virginia. So we spent time with her last year, but one of her daughters in Norfolk, Virginia, actually.
Oh, where are
you
born?
I did see that on your Facebook page. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, she lives in Hampton.
Okay.
And her daughter lives in Atlanta. So I think we're going to fly to Atlanta and then take a car and do Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and then up to Norfolk, and then fly back from Washington, probably. So, but that's in April.
That sounds like a delightful trip.
Yeah. Anyway, shall I pass you back to Jonathan?
Yes, Jonathan? That would be wonderful.
Okay, then. Well, it's lovely talking to you.
It is. The pleasure's been all mine.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, John. Your wife is incredible, but you already knew that.
I did. I'm a very lucky man.
One of the things I like to do as an episode winds down when I have a guest on is to give you an option to either ask some questions of me, or if I didn't raise a topic for you to say, hey, you didn't get me to talk about whatever. I want to talk about something. And I also like to give you the chance to tell people how they can follow you online, websites, social media, any of that kind of stuff.
Okay. I'll kick off with that. I guess most more people have probably seen the stuff that we get up to. Because I have tried very, very hard and failed to maintain a blog. I've tried it twice and I just forget. And it's either too clunky to upload pictures or I just never get the time. Because half of the problem is because we write books during the day, sitting down and typing out for a blog seems like a little bit too much hard work. You know, you're sort of going back to work again, you know, in the evening or something. So I tend to try and maintain as much as I possibly can to sort of keep in touch and show people what we're up to. I use our Facebook page, which is, if you just hunt for Wargame Holidays, you'll find us. There is another Wargame Holidays. I think they're called Wargame Holiday Centre. And they're in Bedfordshire in England, I think. They've got what's left of Peter Gilder's old collection, some old Napoleonic stuff and what have you. But that's not us. We are Wargame Holidays in Crete. So I'm fairly good about putting stuff up there because I paint what happens is, I mean, we're in Crete probably from May through to August every year. And by the time I come back in from Crete in August, I'm all fired up to get the next lot of stuff ready for next season. Because I think, as Diane mentioned, I'd sort of try and add at least a couple of new periods every year to freshen things up. And also, I know also with new collections, I also notice what I'm missing. I could have done with a few more Sherman tanks for Normandy, or I could have done with this. So I'll get those done as well. So in that sort of period, we try and have a break if we can, because believe it or not, spending 2 months or 3 months out in Crete, it sounds like a wonderful working holiday, but it is actually quite hard work. Particularly, when you've got people coming. You've got people coming every week, and even though they're only wargaming for 4 days, those down days are days that Diane and I strip the tables and put the table back up. And if we've got any spare time at all, we'll make stuff and all of that. So it is it's quite full on for the season, which is great. But we try and take a short break when we come back, and then from around sort of September, October time through to about March or so, I just paint like somebody possessed. So I try and get around 2,500 to 3,000 figures painted in that period of time. So right now I'm painting Darkest Africa. I think I've probably done something like 1,500 already for that. Native tribes and various European adventurers and all that kind of thing, and I'm just about to start painting all the Hastings stuff. Luckily, I know the guys at Gripping Beast, and they sorted me out with all the Saxons and the Normans, Saxons rather, and then I know the guy who runs Conquest Games, who does the lovely Norman figures. So the Norman army is going to be exclusively Conquest Games, and the Saxon one will be exclusively Gripping Beast, so that'd be quite fun. So I'm looking forward to doing those. So that's probably the easiest way to find us. Apart, obviously, we've got www.wargameholidays.com, which has got all of our holiday details on there. Really easy to get hold of us. We put news up and photographs and all sorts of bits and pieces up there. There's downloadable sets of rules as well. You can find as well sort of in-house rules that we use for particular periods, that kind of thing. So it's interesting because it's become kind of like about half of my year's work. Gearing up to do all of this stuff for, sort of 2.5-3 months in the summer, is actually takes up about 6 months of my year, and the rest of the year I'm writing books. So it's fun, and it's a good balance.
You put me to shame with the number of figures that you paint and the amount of time you do it. I don't want to tell you how long it would take me to do that. But
I have speeded up a lot over the years. For years and years, I wondered why I was such a slow and terrible painter, and I actually had a medical condition which caused my hands to shake. It wasn't an alcoholic or anything. It wasn't anything to do with delirium tremors or anything like that. It was a genuine medical condition I had, and it was diagnosed. Diane actually noticed that I was doing it. I was sort of having to brace my hand while I was painting to stop it from shaking, and she made me go to the consultant, and the consultant diagnosed me with this particular problem. And I'm on tablets now, and now I can paint. So I think they're magic tablets, which have not only stopped my hand from shaking, but also have allowed me to paint better and quicker. So I'd recommend them to everybody, probably. But No, I mean seriously, I think one of the things that we've been very keen to kind of do and be very clear on right from the outset with War Game Holidays is that we don't buy collections in and just stick them on the table and people play with them. Everything on that table, including the table, you know, from top to bottom, and every single soldier, we have either made it or painted it. And I think that's important because I get asked probably 10 times as many times. But people ask you about the rules and how a particular mechanism works. But for every time I get asked that question once, 10 times I'll be asked, how did you make that? How did you paint that? And I think I've never wanted to be a fraud in the sense that, I had some guy in Sri Lanka have some person paint it for me who's being paid $1 an hour. You know, I think, for some people that's fine, to get stuff pro painted. I mean, I know guys over here who are quite happy to pay £15, which is what, $20 for a 28 millimeter figure to be painted and based and whatever. That's fine. If they want to do that, that's fine. But I always think it's much better to say, you know, this is the fruit of my labor here, you know, and that allows people to see that they can, if I can do it, they can do it.
That's a good message to put out for people.
You know, you don't have to throw money at your hobby. You don't have to throw money at your hobby. There's no shame in buying whatever figures that you can afford, whatever scale that you can afford, and have got room to play, paint them yourself and be proud of it. You know, just be proud of what you have produced yourself. It is your labor, your time, and your love has been put into those soldiers. You know? Because it's your hobby. You know? Fine. To throw money at it is fine because it, you know, in any kind of hobby or pastime, you know, there are ways of doing it. I think if you throw money at a hobby and buy stuff ready done, I think you've got a collection. Yes, you've got a war game collection, but it's a bit like buying art in a gallery or something like that. Yes, you own it, but do you have any ownership of it?
Know exactly what you mean.
You know, I'm not trying to come over all socialist here or anything like that, because it's not about that. It's because, I mean, I'll be the first to admit there are things that I don't want to paint and can't paint. I have this horror of painting Napoleonic, and thank goodness nobody's actually asked me to put on Napoleonic games over there. I think I would probably keel over and have a heart attack if somebody asked me to do that, because that frightens me having to paint Napoleonic figures because they are so fiddly. But it's the collection that we've got over there was originally built out of periods which I found fascinating, particularly the American Civil War. I just have this abiding passion about the American Civil War, and I was overjoyed to be able to go to Gettysburg and Chancellorsville and Antietam, Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania, loads of different battlefield sites, because it's one thing to read about them, it's one thing to look at photographs of them and maps and think you know what the train looks like and everything else. But when you're walking the sights, it doesn't look like anything that you would imagine. Nothing. You know, things are smaller, things are broader, things are deeper, things are more wooded than you'd ever imagine. And it's informed me beyond anything I could possibly have imagined. And I think that's important.
It's good that when people go to the Holiday Center down in Crete, that because you do all this stuff yourself, you and Diane, that the two of you are the ones who you've created everything. You've had the idea and you've seen it through from that image in your head all the way through, that people are able to ask you those questions. And I think that can serve as an icebreaker so that they're not just a person who came and played a game at your place. They become someone that you look forward to coming back and someone who looks forward to spending time with you again and being able to tell their friends, oh, well, I participated in this wonderful game and John was there and Diane was there. It becomes an experience instead of just this thing that they did.
I'm just constantly grateful that people have made the effort to come to that part of Europe, because it's not mainstream Europe. It's not Paris. It's not London. It's not Berlin or Amsterdam or Rome or somewhere like that. It's an island that's actually closer to Libya than it is to the mainland of Europe, believe it or not. The first year we ran it for paying guests, we had two lots of Americans, as Diane said. The second year we had Brazilians come, and I was astounded. I was astounded that they'd come on. It'd taken them four flights to get to us. You know, it was just a huge leap of faith, and that was a wonderful thing. You know, it was a wonderful thing that they'd put so much faith in us, you know, that they were going to enjoy their week on Crete, having flown thousands of miles. And then last year we topped it by having people from Australia, you know, and for us, Australia, we always call it down under Australia in England, because it's literally, if you drilled through the middle of the planet, you'd end up in Australia from England. So, but that was just remarkable.
That's something else.
Yeah, I know. I'm just eternally grateful that people have got that faith, because you can only tell so much from a website. You can only tell so much from, you know, photographs on Facebook or even talking to us or corresponding with us on email, you know. But you know, to make that trip. I mean, I always originally thought that the majority of the people that were going to come to the War Game Holiday Centre were going to be English people, you know, and we kind of set up the whole thing based on the days which normal charter flights come from the UK to Crete, which is on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
But in actual fact, probably only 20-25% of the people that come to us in Crete are actually English. Belgians, Dutch, Danish, French, Italian, Greek, Swedish we've had, you know, which is amazing. And it does really show, there's two things that I've found remarkable about all of this, and that is that wargaming is a small world, you know, that we're all in this little hobby, you know, this niche hobby, and it doesn't matter whether you're in Boston, Massachusetts, or Boston in Lincolnshire, you're using the same set of rules, you're having the same conversations, and you're painting the same soldiers, so we're all part of one kind of fellowship. And the other great thing is that you and I are fortunate in as much as the language of wargaming is English.
We really are.
And, you know, and if these guys that speak Flemish or Italian or whatever want to play Saga or want to play any of the, you know, Hail Caesar or whatever, they've got to have a good grasp of English. And that's great, because there's nothing beats having half a dozen guys walking down the stairs, seeing the 45-foot table with all the stuff on it, all the terrain, the buildings and the soldiers and everything else on it, and being able to talk to one another in English and quickly coalesce into a tight group that is having fun. And that's great.
I think that's a good way
and
for
I think
us.
That's, and that's kind of like job done, if you see what I mean.
This is a great way for us to end this episode. I think if this doesn't convey to people that they need to do two things. One, they need to go and buy your new book, Mega War Games. It's only $50. It's fantastic. And two, they need to hop on their computers, use their mobile devices or whatever, and go to wargameholidays.com and book a fantastic trip of a lifetime down in Crete where they can have some fun with you guys. I don't, if this doesn't tell them that that's what they need to do, I don't know what will. But your wife and you have been so persuasive, and the passion that you both have for all of this, it's so clear, the joy and the wonder that's there, and then all the experience that you bring to all of this, it's truly wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. I love wargaming as much today as I did when I bought my first minifigs, miniature figurine soldiers, for 6.5 English pence, which is about 10 cents, back in about 1973.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's something else.
Yeah. And I know the guy who still makes the same soldiers, which is even weirder.
It really shows, just although some things change as time marches on, so many things do not, just so much stays the same. In a lot of ways, that's nice. It's comforting.
I think so. It's like I have some regiments in my American Civil War collection which are, I'm sure, have got 10 years on you.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
I reckon they're 35, maybe 40 years old.
That'll do it.
And I love them still, and they're in perfect condition, and they still serve me well.
John, it has been an absolute joy to speak with your wife and you, and to have you both as guests for this very special episode. Like I told you, this is something I have been looking forward to for a long time. It's something that's been on a list of mine. I hope that this won't be the only time the two of you appear on the show. I'd love to have you both back sometime.
Of course.
In the future. It you get me speechless. That's not easy to do.
No, that's wonderful. That's great. I'm very pleased to have done this.
Oh, thank you again. And I just want to remind you and our listeners that this is the last episode for the 2013 calendar year. A new episode, episode 106, will come out on January 20th, 2014. I, of course, take the rest of December off because of all the holidays and my birthday. It's me time is what it is. So I can replenish my energies and come up with new ideas to talk about on the show, and to schedule guests like yourself and like your incredible wife, Diane, to come on future episodes. I have quite a lineup of people coming up down the road, talk about all sorts of stuff in 2014. And I'm so glad not only that the two of you were on this episode, but that you were able to be the guest to the other end of the bookshelf for this calendar year. It's a great way to end the recording year, and I'm so truly thankful. And once again, I really hope that you guys see some listeners who've booked holidays with you and who are buying the books. And if anyone does, please tell John and Diane that you heard about things here on the show and that this just excited you enough to go and click on book now and buy now and all that kind of stuff. It's been wonderful. It really has.
It's been a pleasure, and a very happy Christmas to everybody.
And same to you. So I won't keep you any longer, but listeners, and I know you've listened to a few episodes, but listeners know that every single episode, as far as I can recall of this show, I have to end it with a certain phrase, because once or twice I didn't, and then the emails came in. You wouldn't think that it's important, because really, in the scheme of things, it's not when you have all this other stuff happening in the world. But people like to know that no matter what's going on in the world, no matter how much time they're taking to read wonderful books like Mega War Games and plan their fantastic vacations to Crete, that above all else, they have to, they need to, they just, no matter what, gotta keep on gaming.
Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon and all of the other podcasts that you know and love. Or you can always stream and download the latest episode of Wargaming Recon by heading on over to the show notes for that episode.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. We're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
This is Andreas, Apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.
If you heard it and you do like it, good. If you don't like it, what I'm supposed to do.